What is up, Asymmetry? How y'all doing? It's time to circle back to Bonsai Geekery, like at its finest. I love talking Bonsai. I love going deep. It's definitely not the eclectic conversation when we start to deal with fan questions from the forum that we can have with some of our other guests that appear on the podcast. But we're going to dig in, and we're going to dig in hardcore. So for all you Bonsai junkies out there, let's do it. Now, before I start, if you haven't checked out the Broadleaf calendar on the Mirai mobile app, spring is upon us, buds are a-swelling, and it's time to get your deciduous Broadleaf evergreen and, in general, Broadleaf groove on. It's on Mirai mobile. If you haven't signed up, visit live.bonsaimirai.com, create an account, try it for free, get that subscription, and then you can go download the app and start rocking out on the Bonsai Guide that will tell you what to do when you need to do it. And we'll answer the why questions that come up inevitably as you pursue the Bonsai practice. Check it out. Support us. We appreciate you guys. All right, here we go. Fan questions. I think this one was based around repotting. And we start off with Joe C. How long do you typically put the tree on a heat mat post-repot? And are there any signs you're looking for to know when to transition it off? And let's see. What, Joe, did you try to give me a twofer? Anyways, let me just talk about the heat mat for a minute. Listen, single most important horticultural thing you can do besides appropriate watering, which let's just start with appropriate watering, thoroughly soaking, washing, getting rid of all of the dust, and hydrating the tree after the repot is the most important watering that tree will ever experience. Letting the tree dry out between that initial watering post-repot and the second watering. Getting oxygen into the system is where we get compartmentalization of cuts, of damage, of breaks in the roots. And with that second watering, compartmentalization, callus formation, boom, you've got oxygen in the system, and now you deliver water to get that balance of water and oxygen and thoroughly hydrate that system a second time. And that's when you promote that root growth and that recovery from repotting. If you keep a tree too wet, new roots will never grow. That's where we start to see atrophy and decline. And if you keep a tree too dry post-repot, it is very, very challenging for that tree to recover, okay? But to enhance, so that's the watering portion, a number one most important. Doesn't matter what kind of magic sauce you apply to the tree. Doesn't matter what temperature you have a heat bed at. Doesn't matter what voodoo dance you're going to do. If you're not watering correctly, you are toast after the repot. But if you create a warmer environment in the roots than the ambient air temperature around the foliage, you focus the tree's energy expenditures on the repair of the root system post-repot. And this is where we see the heat mat, cool air temperatures, warm root zone temperatures. Originally, I started at 70 degrees Fahrenheit. I moved up to 75. I went to 80. We keep our heat beds at 80 degrees Fahrenheit now and have found that that keeps our root zone temperature inside of the container right around 70 degrees Fahrenheit with air temperatures as low as we can get them, just above freezing if possible. Mid to high 30s typically is sort of the average over the course of the spring. And that 70 degree root zone temperature and that, you know, high 30, 40 degree foliar temperature, ambient air temperature, boom. Root growth is initiated within 10 days of repotting a tree, watering it correctly, and putting it on the heat bed. Now, when do I take it off of the heat bed? This is the question. First and foremost, as you see the buds swell, it means that water is moving, roots are recovering, and the tree is starting to deliver resources. If you're repotting early, you haven't seen the buds swell. You see the buds swell on the heat bed, you move that off into a bench and start the transition. If the buds are already moving when you repot, then I think you need at least 10 days for that heat bed to initiate root growth. And I like to leave it at least 2 weeks to gain some benefit. The longer you leave it, the better. But the warmer the ambient air temperatures get, the less effective the heat mat is. So there is a balance later in the spring as you repot to how long you leave it on, how effective it is, and when you should start that transition. Now, Joe tried to squeeze in a twofer. I'm going to go ahead and grace Joe with a little bit of understanding here. I'm not even sure how to phrase this as a question, but if Ryan could explain thoughts around approaching old root-bound nursery stock that have a large percentage of large structural roots circling all the way down. I understand both concepts of starting with the point of greatest limitation and finding the nabari, but these types of situations create a theory of trade-off. So how does he think through this situation? Here's the deal. When we're handling Yamadori, you're dealing with a tree that's, you know, at least if it's a reasonable Yamadori that had any sort of stock or value in being collected, you're talking at least 100 years old in the mountains, all right? Or in the landscape, for the most part, right? Now, there's exceptions to that, but let's just say 100 years. So you already have a tree that has a lot of internal complexity from existing processing, toxicities, deficiencies, being starved to some degree or another, which is why it's 100 years old plus and still the size that makes it capable of being a bonsai. When you're dealing with nursery stock, a root-bound nursery stock might be 10 years old, 12 years old, 15 years old at the most, maybe 20, but most likely 20-year-old nursery stock, bald and burlapped, up-potted and handled correctly. Something's gone right to get 20 years in a nursery container. So we're saying, listen, you're talking about a young tree, a young, young tree. And in that instance, you know, the greatest limitation in any nursery stock is digging down on the surface to find the actual nabari and the actual base of the tree and wading through all of the roots that start to tell you maybe I'm the base, but actually you keep going and you find a better and better base down below. And once you find that base and you start coming up from the bottom, you're going to have to be cutting thicker roots. You're going to have to be correcting circling roots, structural flaws, crossing roots, etc. But you're dealing with such a young tree that hopefully we haven't styled, hopefully has a massive amount of foliar mass, which gives us the capacity to go very hard on that initial repot, kill it or make it a bonsai, correct the things that are an issue, knowing that that is the strongest it's going to be, right? And attack that root system to try and correct the things that need to be corrected. Because if you put off correcting things and you're so worried about the tree, granted, we love the tree, we need to be respectful. It's a piece of nursery stock. That's almost the same thing as a lab rat, although they do develop their own character over time that allows them to diversify. It's a monoculture crop, right? You might as well put yourself in the situation of having the best possible material outcome, correction of flaws, etc., if you're going to invest the time and care moving forward. Bonsai is not cheap. Bonsai is not easy. It demands dedication. Make sure you're dedicating your time to good material that you've handled and given the opportunity to either be good or not take your time and effort, all right? That's what we got, Joe. Hilton, what do you got for me? I know this is a super broad question, but instead of every X years to repot, are there actually things we should be looking for? Okay, so any bonsai practitioner that has followed Mirai knows that there is not an assigned X number of years between repots. This is like the original Sunset Magazine bonsai book, how to garden special, repot your trees every 3 to 5 years, sort of a blanket statement, and it's total garbage, right? Because there's so many different things. You might put a young piece of nursery stock from a giant container into a tiny bonsai container, and 1 year later you have to repot that tree, even though it's a pine. Or you might put a piece of Yamadori into a bonsai container, and you might not do the second repot for 8 to 10 years. And so you say, well, what determines whether I repot or not? There's three factors. Number one, did we lose water percolation? Water has got to penetrate the surface of the soil and get into that tiny little vessel that you're growing this tree in order for that tree to survive. And primarily, water needs to penetrate the sheen of the tree or the root system underneath the trunk, okay? If you're not getting water percolating, that sheen is going to dehydrate over the course of time, and you're going to start to see all kinds of bad things happen. Primarily, you're going to see the apex get weak, you're going to have random branch flagging and dieback, and then you're going to watch that tree decline. Okay, so percolation. Now, we recognize percolation can be lost just by the breakdown of Akadama on the surface, of accumulated moss, of fine root mass, of organic fertilizer clogging up that system, and we can clean that surface off with a vacuum and a chopstick, get down to solid intact particles, retop dress the surface, and you might have another year or two to get out of that before you repot. But if water percolation is lost and we dig through that first, you know, small layer of surface and we're not seeing intact soil particles, we're seeing a dense root mass, or we're just seeing a solid block of something, then you got to repot to ensure percolation. Loss of percolation, number one. Number two, decomposition. Tree is staying too wet. High disease issues. I've got all kinds of problems. We don't want to repot a tree when it's weak. We want to tilt it up on an angle, regain the balance of water and oxygen, try to get the tree strong again and producing aggressive growth, and then we come back in and repot, ideally. But sometimes we've got to repot a weak tree because we say, this soil system sucks. It's falling apart. It's broken down. There's no oxygen. There's a tremendous amount of water being held here, and I'm not going to get this tree back to a state of health if I leave it in it, okay? Loss of percolation, number one. Decomposition, number two. Number three, hey, listen, this is all about aesthetics. Anybody who didn't get that memo right? We focus on the horticulture to be able to achieve the aesthetics. And let's just be really honest, we all suffer through the horticulture to be able to enjoy the aesthetics because it isn't easy. We are engaging in a horticultural conundrum. It's an anomaly. It is not the place that is ideal. That's why we grow trees in the confined, shallow, containerized environment, because it constricts the growth. It shortens the internodes. It shrinks the leaves. Yes, we achieve a greater density of branching per square inch in a bonsai form than would ever be realistic, possible, or sustainable in the natural world, okay? And that's what gives us the proportion and scale. But this is all about aesthetic. I want to change the front. I want to rotate it. I'm going to shift the angle. I'm going to restyle the tree. I'm going to change the pot and improve it. I'm going to shrink it. I'm going to grow it, right? Change of aesthetics, number three. Hilton, my man, let's go ahead and use those functional aspects of why we would repot and your tree will be better for it. Stephen S., Mariah team, hello. Hey. Thank you very much for this new way of interacting. You got it, Stephen. I love the podcast. Finding guests is always a fun challenge, but there's a lot of bonsai discussions to be had. So I'm psyched that we're doing this. And I love the forum. Engaging with you guys more is definitely priority number one as we move into this new era of Mirai and Mirai Mobile, an app that's going to guide your bonsai process. Love the podcast, especially because I listen to them on the way to and from work, which usually is unproductive time in the car. But with the podcast, I can do bonsai while driving. Amen. Thank you for the chance to pick your brain. Here's a few of my questions. How do you determine if you can style and repot a tree in the same year? Usually one says to do one major operation action to a tree per year, but what if during the repot you removed only a minimal amount of roots? What are the signs that you can style a tree after repotting? What takes priority with new material, especially nursery material, styling or repotting? Ah, okay, I see. We're going to get into this. Well, let me just go ahead and say this. Listen, one of the things that people do not digest and take seriously enough is just simply answering the question, what phase of development is this tree in, right? And we recognize phase of development. Is it in primary development, where we're elongating, thickening, we're healing, we're rebuilding the roots, we're expanding foliar mass to get backbudding? Those are your five developmental goals in primary branch development, or the primary phase of development, right? Some branches are going to be in primary, while other branches are in secondary and even tertiary, okay? But in general, we always cater to the highest level of refinement. You cannot refine a tree if less than 70% of the foliage is not in refinement. So if all of a sudden we have a few branches where we're like, that's awesome, but the rest of the tree we're letting to grow, then those few branches that are awesome, we can't do refinement actions to those, and now we're in either secondary or primary. Okay, so when you start to think about this, the general trend, what is 70% of the canopy of your tree doing? That tells you the state of development of your tree. When you are doing an initial styling, an initial repotting, whether it's nursery stock, whether it's Yamadori, whether it's field-grown material, anytime you're doing an initial anything, one major operation per year, period, no negotiation, okay? I'm not going to go style a piece of Yamadori and then walk it down to the greenhouse and repot it. I'm not going to repot a piece of Yamadori and then go styling it. I'm not going to style my nursery stock and then go repot it, right? I can't do those things at once. That's why we say, listen, repot your nursery stock first and then give it a year to recover and style it the following spring. Or style your Yamadori first after it's recovered, and then wait a year, and then go do the repot, okay? Because those are all primary, initial, big moves, big reductions, big bends, lots of wire, lots of pruning, okay? You get into the second repot. Now maybe we're removing, you know, the remaining field soil, the remaining nursery soil, the remaining mountain soil. So now we've got a sheen replacement. Well, we're not going to be styling and reducing the foliar mass and then doing this major operation. Or maybe we're doing a second styling and we're wiring out even more branches because we're taking the growth and we're harnessing it. Well, I'm not going to do that and prune and reallocate resources and reset the navigation system of hormone at the tips and then go repot it, right? So primary and secondary, one operation per year. Now, it's when you get into tertiary refinement, where your root system is refined, your canopy is refined, where I'm happy to go ahead and prune because we're never going to remove more than 50% in a refinement action. And I'm happy to go repot after that because we have a refined, skilled root system that we're going to take off the surface, walls, and bottom. Maybe we're going to excavate a little bit of, you know, pockets of decayed organic, but it's not going to be that heavy application. That is when we can get into a little bit more than one application per year. And in fact, you have to maintain refinement, right? Be able to double dip occasionally with a tree that's strong and ready for those actions. All right, I'm going to keep going. What takes priority with new material, especially nursery material, styling, or repotting? Repotting, repotting, repotting with nursery stock. Listen, unless you're dealing with an overgrown tree that got that is atrophying in a one-gallon container, and even then I'm going to say you need to repot that first. Nursery stock is held in a highly organic soil in a large can, and because of that, if we reduce that foliar mass, any nursery stock that's handled appropriately is being up-potted to give it the space and room to grow. But even if it's root-bound, we still need to repot first to correct the roots. If it's in a giant nursery can and it's healthy, we need to repot to reduce the soil mass around the canopy, because the moment that you style that tree on a piece of nursery stock, chances are you're removing 50-plus percent, maybe 70-plus percent. If you haven't shrunk down the soil mass first, you're going to have a tree that's going to start to decline because of an imbalance of water and oxygen. You've got 20 to 30% of the foliar mass in this giant nursery can with organic soil that holds tons of water. That's one of the biggest faux pas and no-nos that you can engage with, and that's why we say repot nursery stock first. When creating a raft, how do you determine at what depth the pot to pot the trunk for ideal root growth? Ah, ha, 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 ha. Yeah, so if you watch the hornbeam raft creation from the field-grown nursery stock at Tom Roberts, my priority was to get the raft into the middle layer, the middle to lower layer of the soil system. The biggest mistake people make in air layering, raft creation, etc., when they're trying to get roots to grow, is they keep that system too close to the surface. There's an inconsistency of wet, dry, there's sunlight, there's all manner of things. Soil's moving, get washed away, even though it's top dressed, etc. You want to get it to the middle, or better yet, down low in the container, because lower in the container is really where your oxygen water balance, and primarily oxygen as well as heat being held in the container, especially if you're setting it on the ground, exists. And that is what will proliferate the roots at the very, very best. Okay. The worst case scenario is having it too shallow. Okay. You got it. Steven, thanks a lot for your help. I wish you, all of you at Mirai, a great week. Same to you, my friend. Neek, my team, a good new development, exclamation point, my man. I like Ryan going off topic with a story from the past, and this gives him time to rant freely. Yeah, we're three questions deep, and I've already started to rant. It's going to get worse before it gets better. My question is about watering post-repot. I remember you talking about waiting for the top dressing to dry, but I recall that being on a heat bed. Does that rule still apply in a non-heat bed situation? And how long would you dare to go without watering after a repot? Okay, so we already touched on this a little bit as the most important thing post-repot, but there are levels to dryness that we all have to appreciate in the bonsai practice, okay? I'm never going to let a Japanese maple or a beech or a hornbeam or a trident, I'm never going to let an azalea get as dry as I'm going to let a pine, right? And so when we start to think about this, the amount and the degree of dryness differs, because on a broadleaf tree like a maple or a high water mobility tree, when I see that top dressing dry out, I'm going to water it, okay? But on a pine or a juniper, when I see that top dressing dry out, I'm seeing, because I'm not coating with top dressing so thick that I can't see some degree of a soil particle beneath it, I'm now, once the top dressing is dry, going to give it a little more time. On a heat bed, another half of a day. If I'm going to go home at night, I'm going to feel it, I'm going to think about it, and I'm going to really gauge that. If I'm going to be there all day, I'm going to be watching it, okay? But I'm going to give it more time. If it's on a bench, I got another day to allow the soil particles to thoroughly dry out, because the oxygen in the system is so important, is so, so important. And here's the deal. Once the top dressing dries out, if you're in a protected environment where there's no wind and no, incredibly strong sun, there's still usable water inside of that container. Now, once they go out onto the bench, we know that that system changes rapidly. There's more elements causing transpiration through the foliar mass, and we've got to be a little bit more on point. You have leniency in a greenhouse, and you want to push that leniency to allow the oxygen back into the system. But there are levels to the amount of dryness that any species and genre can tolerate, and it comes down to their water mobility. Those high water mobility trees, we cannot let them dry out as much. All right? Jergen, a week after repotting, the soil mix in the sphagnum is still wet. What should I do? Nothing. Nothing. If it's outside in the rain, certainly remove it from the rain. If you're protecting it, continue to look at it, you know? I mean, if you are really nervous, tilt it up on an angle, see if you could get any excess water out. But It is very common. Look, people expect trees to just take open heart surgery of repotting. This is repotting is open heart surgery, y'all. Like, let's understand. This isn't like, I'm going to do this to my tree and it's just going to feel great and bounce back. It's like, yeah, let's chop you open, completely destroy the pump system for vascular resources that drive your ability to function as a human being. And then let's kick you out the door and see how fast you can walk to your car. You know what I'm saying? Like, it is not practical to expect a tree after a repot to just continue moving forward as if nothing ever happened. It is the open heart surgery of the plant world. Okay. So if it's not drying out, that's fine. Wait for it to dry out. Very common for after the first watering, post repot at Marai, for the trees to go 7-10 days before I'll water them again, before they finally dry out. And sometimes I sit there and I look and I go, oh, geez, did I go too far? Did I do something wrong? You know, inevitably, patience is a virtue. You let it dry out and then you come back in and you hydrate that and things take off after that. You see the behavior change. If you don't let it dry out, you start fooling with it, you start tampering with it, you start thinking that there's something that you need to fix, that is when things start going drastically the opposite direction. You got to be patient. Always patient. Put the weight on the tree. And yay. Please talk about any nuances you find in the repotting of Doug Fir. Oh my gosh, Doug Fir. I'm going to talk about this all day. When was the last time you messed up or made a mistake in a repot and how did you respond to that? First of all, Douglas Fir. Okay. So Douglas Fir and Engelmann spruce are these two nasty, nasty. And I say nasty in a good way and I say nasty in a bad way. They're nasty awesome when you get these old, craggly, just badass, bitchin', stunted trees that are old and rugged, you know, and when they get really old and they're stunted, the Engelmann and the Doug Fir are high water utilizers in the mountains, but they can endure drought and harsh, rugged conditions, typically under the shelter of a larger canopy overhead, okay? Not because it doesn't allow them to dry out, but it just cuts the intensity of the elements acting on them. That's typically where you find the oldest and most contorted. Sometimes exposed in a not south-facing kind of west, slightly northwest, right, or southeast. They have a little bit of a buffer. But the thing that allows Engelmann and Doug Fir, Pseudotsugamon's ACI, to exist in this environment is this dense black organic soil, which is just decomposing organic matter, right? And when they are collected with this dense black mass, you then put them into pumice or some sort of soil substrate in a recovery box. That is one of the toughest watering conditions to engage with because you can very easily overwater. And I would say the majority of Engelmann and Doug Fir that do not succeed are overwatered. Okay. So when we start to talk about repotting them, Doug Fir and Engelmann will produce sections of roots that move outside of that dense black organic mass. But a lot of times with Doug Fir, most of the roots will still be contained inside of that, even though it has given you buds on old wood that tell you it's recovered and sort of insinuate it's time to either style or repot, okay? So when you get into it, don't be surprised if the black mass is kind of where all the roots are and there aren't a lot of roots growing into the pumice environment, even if it's been in there for 2 years, which is a mandatory amount of time to leave a tree in a recovery container, at least 2 years, okay? But you have to break up the outer edges of that black mass, and you've got to expose sections of roots, fine roots, thicker roots, not cut them back to the black mass, but leave that black mass off of them, leave it informally broken up and irregular, and leave those roots exposed, because in the first repot, that is what allows the two different soil systems to come together in the bonsai container. And by having those exposed roots on Doug Fir and Engelmann spruce moving into the aggregate system of the pumice lava Akadama mixture, you automatically start to force the tree to adapt to that new condition and circumstance. You know, coming out of collection, you're not going to break up that root mass putting it into pumice. That's a nightmare, right? You just want to get survival. Going into a bonsai pot, we've got to merge the soil systems. When was the last time you messed up or made a mistake in a repot and how did you respond to that? I made a monstrosity of a mistake. If anybody saw the professional RMJ styling part 1 and 2, one of the better Rocky Mountain junipers I've ever had, that tree's dead. I killed it. Yeah, I'm sorry to say that. That's really sucks. I've lost to date in 14 years at Mariah. I've lost four trees that I'll never forget. And the professional is one of them. I had a Rocky Mountain juniper called Bacon. And I think it ultimately froze to death, which is unusual, but it was a big tree in a small box and I knew better. I had the gut instinct to greenhouse it and I didn't. And I just got too cold one time. And when you got a box full of roots, juniper roots are not as hardy. You know, bad things happened. I had a tree that we called the Kraken, which was easily the oldest tree I've ever worked on. Really nasty root coil repot. I mean, we went through hell and back with Kraken. It was amazing. It was a bonsai container. It started to decline. Couldn't figure it out. If I knew what I knew now with apical and the nutrition, I would have been able to turn that tree around in a heartbeat, wouldn't have even flinched. And it's gutting to know that, but part of the game. So yeah, the professional 2 years ago, Troy and I did the repot. It was a complicated repot to get the angle that we presented with the box. Had some heavy root manipulation. I'm assuming that I probably did a multitude of things wrong, but I believe I probably damaged the live vein in the repot, and it stayed around for 2 years, but it was fading the entire time. And, you know, those trees that sort of slowly decline, generally over the entirety of the canopy, they're the most gutting. You know, hope is the last thing to die. But hey, listen, I make mistakes. The reason I know so much about bonsai is because I made a ton of mistakes. People say, oh, Mr. Kimura taught you all that. You cannot teach people bonsai in the level that we know it at Mirai. It comes from doing it. Prolific body of work, tremendous number of trees, lots and lots of different scenarios, pushing the design envelope, engineering, technical, horticulture. We've been pushing it on all fronts of bonsai for a very long time. For 14 years, redlining the RPM of what's possible with native material and how far we can push the aesthetics and the horticulture and the asymmetry of things, you're going to fail. You're going to fail. If you don't find that outer boundary and that bumper rail, then you're not trying hard enough. But it is painful. I'm going to tell you right now, it is painful. All right, Chris. Ryan, during times of stress, which is always, how do you maintain your bonsai practice and keep your passion alive? Are there specific strategies or rituals you rely on to stay connected to your craft and find solace amidst challenging moments? Well, you know, I think I've talked about sort of my personal journey a little bit and very vaguely, and it's something that I'll probably continue to keep relatively vague. But, you know, Mirai and sort of my life as like an individual has been in constant state of turmoil ever since the birth of Mirai Live. Honestly, like when Mirai Live started, there were a lot of days that I didn't think I was going to be able to do the stream. And, you know, the cameras, the team would count down and the cameras would go on. And if you know anything about being in front of a camera, you can't talk normal. You have to up your energy level just to sound normal on a camera. If you talk normal, you sound like you're totally depressed and want to go home. You know, so I had to bring that energy. But I have to be really honest with you, you know, bonsai for me, it's a lifestyle. It's a career. There's a lot of pressure in that. But the lifestyle component of it is to say that bonsai still gives me more than it takes. And those cameras would come on, things would be not good personally for me. And suddenly I would have my hands in a tree and people would be asking questions and we'd be having a conversation and all the troubles melted away. You know, bonsai ultimately is my salve. Now, if you're in the wrong frame of mind when you're working on bonsai, sometimes you can do a lot of damage to a tree and you've got to know yourself. There's a technical capacity. You've got to understand your limitations. You know, you've always got to put the tree first. There's all of these like fundamental backbones to this. And I've had years where I've done more damage than I've been positive to trees in the garden because I just wasn't in the right frame of mind. I've had, you know, trying to make a business out of bonsai, trying to learn how to be a good boss, a good employer, rebuilding my house for several years now, trying to create the infrastructure in this garden to be able to accomplish the things that we want to accomplish, working internationally, teaching students, you know, it's been a lot. And that's really kind of what's led to some of the changes that I've made lately, because I'm really in the prime of my career right now. And I want to be making trees. I want to be the one that has my hands on my garden. I want to be pushing the envelope and seeing how far we can take this whole thing. The app is out. I'm going to continue to stream. I love engaging with the community. We're not going anywhere, but Ryan needed to keep his blade as sharp as possible. And let's all be honest, how many bonsai professionals are continuing? It's not about can you start a bonsai business. It's about how long what's your longevity in the game? You know, even in Japan, bonsai professionals wash out. Not many apprentices ever make it over the long run as a bonsai professional. People don't realize this. In the United States, people wash out, people leave, people quit, businesses fail. And I look at this and I say, okay, listen, it's not just about what I can do now. It's about how long can you stay in the game? How can you stay passionate about the game? How do you continue to move forward? How do you take people with you? How does the high tide continue to raise all ships? What's the next move? Bonsai has to adapt to the social constructs that exist around us. Social media used to be a good tool for business. It is not anymore. How do you get the word out? How do you tell people that this is better? How do you tell people you can help them and improve them? And then how do you keep yourself whole in the process of thinking about all of these external things? And for me, it comes back to showing up every day, even if it's to clean the workshop, even if it's just to water, even if it's to open up the greenhouse doors, because once I get into that position, camera comes on, doesn't matter how bad the day is, you put your hands on a tree in bonsai, that should make it better. If you are a passionate practitioner, the act of doing bonsai should make you better. I am more passionate about bonsai right now than I've ever been. You know, and I say that on an annual basis. Sometimes I've meant it. Sometimes I was saying it to try and talk myself into it because things weren't that good. But at this point, I love it more than ever. And that is absolutely sincere. Josh, how do you balance the need for root pruning during repotting with minimizing stress on the tree? On a personal note, how have you been finding balance and inspiration in your bonsai work recently? All right. So root pruning, you know, think about pruning roots, because people kind of prune roots as if they're like buzzing somebody's head. You know, it's like, all right, I got all these roots and now I just cut them back to the edge of the root ball and stick her back in there. It's like, no, that's not really what we're doing, because pruning the roots is as concise of an operation as pruning the branches. Think about drop crotch pruning back to secondary, back to tertiary roots. Think about balancing the root mass throughout the root ball so that you have the same amount of, you know, roots, and obviously you have to create this kind of construct. But coming out of a growing box, you're going to have a lot of roots if a tree's been handled correctly as a Yamadori, or if you repot it first as nursery stock the first time you repot it, you know, once it's been in a bonsai container, you're going to have a lot of roots. And now all of a sudden you start this refinement of root pruning. You've got to create space, but you're not trying to hedge clip the root system. You're trying to drop crotch prune and create accurate transitions of strength to refine that system. Okay, and that's very, very important that you understand that. So minimizing stress on the tree. Listen, repotting is going to be stressful. Timing is appropriate. Building up the foliar mass, having the energy stocked in the tree is how I minimize the stress. Root pruning is a part of it. Obviously, every tree is different. Sometimes a Yamadori tree in a first repot, we save every single root and we don't prune a single one. Most of the time in the first repot, we prune some roots. But once we start getting that robust root system, dealing with deciduous species, dealing with our deciduous conifers like a bald cypress, Don Redwood, or a larch, you're going to have to do pruning to get that tree into a bonsai container and to refine it and to take the coarseness out of it and to transition the hormonal load from auxin to cytokine and dominant growth. You got to be looking at pruning back, drop crotch pruning, really refining that root system in the same way we handle the canopy. How do I find balance and inspiration in bonsai work? So balance is not really a thing that Ryan does well. People have told me that I need to find balance or they're worried about me burning out from literally the first year I've been doing that. And that was, like I said, it's 2024. I started this place in 2010. People were telling me in college when I was 18 years old, I needed to find balance or I was going to burn out. Maybe they're right. I'm 42. Maybe I'm going to be 42. I was born in 81 and it's 2000. Yeah, I'll be 43 this year. Yeah, I really have not found balance to be my jam. I like the prolific body of work concept of what it takes to be an artist, because, you know, I like the challenge. I like to be busy. I like to have lots to look at, lots to do. I think it's fun. I think it's really fun. It can be overwhelming. I can work myself into a corner and it can be very overwhelming. But ultimately, if I'm the one doing the bonsai work, it for me, the goal of this whole thing was to do bonsai. I became a bonsai professional so I could do bonsai all day long, right? And we've had to build a company. We've had to build a business. We've had to figure out how to make a living as a bonsai professional in the Western world, which being a traveling entertainer is not the way that you get better at bonsai. And I wanted to get better at bonsai. I want to see what the level, I want to see what the ceiling of this whole thing is. I want to push the envelope and take the community with us at Mirai. being a traveling entertainer is not the way that you do that. So, you know, we had to build an educational system. We built an app, and it took a lot of people, a lot of talented people, a lot of resources, a lot of time, a lot of energy. Took a lot from me. But worth it to be making a living. The balance of things, not my priority. The inspiration comes from the native landscape. The Mariah and the Wild projects, like, people are like, oh, that's cool and stuff. No. I literally feel like I'm getting to the roots and origin of religion when I'm out there. And I feel like bonsai could be considered a vanity-based art form, aesthetically driven for the reason of looking nice. And they wouldn't be wrong unless the purpose and context of the creation is to accomplish something greater than vanity. And that's really where conservation, sustainability, working with the ancient forest society, you know, trying to figure out things nutritionally that can and do save the Pulian olives, and all of these projects, you know, we go do a Mariah and the Wild project and we become one with that ecosystem. We learn the topography, the elements, the shapes, the forms of the ages and the life cycles of the trees in these incredibly grand environments that we're so rich and privileged to have access to. A lot of the world does not have that. Oldest, largest, and tallest tree in the world in the Western United States, 11 grand champion trees on the peninsula of the Olympic. You know, I don't think people realize how special North American continent is, but, you know, Europe has similar opportunities. And these landscapes have to be represented, and bonsai has the ability to conserve, sustain, and motivate people to take action in a positive direction. That is where I get inspired. All right, so we go from balance and inspiration. Rob S., have you encountered any particularly challenging or unique situations during bonsai repotting that took you by surprise? And how did you handle it? Rob, I'm going to say every repotting takes me by surprise, but I generally tell my students, and I've found this figure to be pretty darn accurate, 9 out of 10 times you're going to get better than you bargained for, and 1 out of 10 times it's going to be far worse than you could have imagined. And so if you consider it like that, and we do 250 repots in a spring season, 25 of those are going to be a repot that I have nightmares about. But here's the thing. I think, you know, when you're trying to learn this complex task of the open heart surgery in the form of bonsai that is repotting, we're all trying to know, and, you know, I'm very familiar with this sensation because it was how I felt before I went to Japan. It was how I felt during a majority of my apprenticeship, and it's how I've felt over the past 14 years. I want to know. I want to know what I'm doing is right. I want to know what I'm doing. The tree's going to live. I want to know what I'm doing is going to have a good outcome. I want to know. I want that assurance. And one thing that I've learned over, so 14 years, and say we've been repotting 200 plus trees for the entirety of 14 years. I mean, every spring. So that's over 2,800 trees. Check my math on that. It's pretty rough and a stab in the dark. I don't want to sit here and really calc it out, but I'm more of a visual person than that's more than 2,000 trees for sure. So that means that in those 2,000 plus trees that have been repotted, somewhere in that journey, I started just recognizing that every repot is going to be its own experience that's going to require thinking and creativity and engineering and care for the tree to both maximize its aesthetic, the tree container combination, but also to get the tree through that surgery in a way that allows it to recover. And the more that you acquiesce to not knowing and knowing that you're not going to know, and the more confidence you can build in yourself in understanding you've got the skills and the techniques and the creativity to respond to any situation, the more fun that repotting gets and the better the outcome is. Now, that's easy for me to say with all of that experience under my belt, talking to, you know, somebody who's a bonsai beginner. You can't take the desire to know away. In fact, the desire to know is the virus that is the bonsai passion that causes us to suddenly have 200 trees that are all in development and wonder how we get to that place where we actually have really good trees and where we're actually capable of doing bonsai and having fun. And that's a big, long journey, right? And the value of the whole pursuit is the journey. It's not having the finished tree in the end. That's the byproduct. That's not actually what makes it all worth it, right? Even though that's the carrot, that's, we all learn, it's the process. But here's one that I'll give you just as a solid something to grab onto. We deal with a lot of crack root trees, and reducing the greatest limitation, which on a piece of Yamadori and a big long box is always going to be the farthest end of that box. And as you're reducing, the greatest fear is that you're going to encounter a root that turns back into the major root system and probably holds a majority of the roots that support that tree. That's the worst case scenario because you can't reduce that crack root. Well, one of the creative things that I've learned that gave rise to the rubber band theory of, you know, height to width, container proportion, the same visual mass distributed width, shallow, wide, or deep, narrow, fits the same tree and accommodates that dreaded situation of having a root that turns back on a crack root tree that prevents you from reducing the length and whatnot. I've learned how to turn that into a continuation of the trunk. And it was a major focus working with my class that was on site last week. We ran into a few crack root ponderosas that I knew were going to be very problematic. And there is, you know, this tool that's in my, this arrow that's in my quiver, this tool that's in my box now, where learning how to turn a crack root into a continuation of the trunk and maximize that capacity means when you find that root that turns back, now we start reducing the root ball from the closest point towards the trunk and exposing as much of that trunk and that root as possible to try and reduce the root system to be able to fit into an appropriately proportioned container without losing quality and interest and without having to sacrifice the desired angle and the desired aesthetic of the tree. Okay, so that is, I would say, one intangible lesson I can pass on to you that I have had to really cultivate, because 25 out of 250 trees are going to be that nightmare repot, and you've got to be able to adapt and adjust. All right. Number 10, I have a newly acquired ginkgo, which has been either air layered or has the stump of a taproot fully healed all the way to the bottom of a relatively deep pot. The nabari isn't great, but workable. In a future repot, should I reduce the stump and create a new wound or accept the limitation in pot dimensions? Also, will this impact the health of the sheen if there are limited roots at the bottom of the stump? So here's what I would say. I would say, where are your effective roots in terms of fine roots that conduct water and nutrition? If it's around the not so great nabari, but it's passable, workable, I can improve it, then I would say that that stump is unnecessary and you would be best served to reduce that stump or fully remove that stump. And it sounds to me like you're probably dealing with an air layer, because a ginkgo having a substantial taproot, unless it was a massive tree in the ground, and even then, that's not necessarily how ginkgo grows. I'm assuming that is the remnants of a trunk that was not eliminated when that tree was separated. That was probably where the growing container that held the air layered roots existed. They cut it at the bottom of the container, they stuck it into a pot, and now you have this big stump as a result. In fact, I'm almost positive that that's what you're dealing with. And there may be some functional roots on that. If there are functional roots or the majority of the functional roots on that stump, then you got to rethink things, and I'm totally wrong about the air layering strategy. But if there are no roots on that stump or limited roots on that stump, cut that sucker off and enjoy being able to put your ginkgo into an appropriately sized container. Absolutely. Okay, now there is one limitation in bonsai to cutting a stump off that exists inside of the root system, and that exists inside of bog-collected trees, okay? Whether it's a bog-collected larch, whether it's a bog-collected spruce, bog-collected trees, the stumps that exist below the sometimes self-layered roots, when that tree is collected, can be reduced. If not reduced at the collection point and those stumps form callus and heal, it is a deal breaker to remove that stump. And we used to encounter this periodically in Japan with Ezo spruce from Hokkaido, where they are in like more of a muskeg permafrost kind of environment, and they kind of self-layer at the surface, and they were cut, you know, and severed and removed, and then that cut root in the growing container over the next few years of recovery healed. When you cut that root, it's almost like you cut one end of a straw and release the tension on the water chain. That would be the exception. Your ginkgo is not that situation. Cut the stump and rock out. All right. Alex E. Hey, Mirai team. Is it okay to repot a deciduous tree in the spring and then air layer that tree the same year? Especially in this case, a Chinese quince already in bone-size substrate and a Japanese maple repot from nursery can substrate to training pot bone-size substrate. Oh, okay. I say especially in these cases. Okay, so one, the quince is in a bone-size pot and Akadama. The other, a maple, is in a nursery can. Should he repot it and can he air layer? Okay, here's the deal. So anytime that you repot a tree, you are going to slow down its capacity to respond physiologically to any activity. But you're dealing with a broadleaf deciduous, which is the highest level of water mobility. If the tree produces a strong flush of foliar mass after the repot, you're not going to be air layering that tree until you get that foliar mass post-hardened off and energy is being returned to the root system. I would give it, because you've repotted it, a month more time to feed the root system, root recovery, etc. So instead of, you know, end of May, early June, you might be end of June, early July taking that air layer. But if it produced a robust foliar mass, you're not going to be partially defoliating or pruning. You're not going to be trying to hold the shape of that foliar mass intact while you're air layering. You could delay that air layer a month from ideal timing, give the tree time to rebuild its, to a slight degree, its root system after the repot, and then take the air layer, and I think you would have success. Now, are you going to have as much success with as robust of a push out of roots and as significant of a response as you would if the tree had not been repotted? No. But do you need to repot the tree to get it to a state of health, to get it into a circumstance or a situation where you can even fathom the air layer? That's often the scenario. If the material is good enough, I would wait a year to rebuild its strength and really get it robust. If you're saying, yeah, it's good, but I can afford to roll the dice, go for it. Go for it. And for most air layers, I do tend to look at it and say, okay, I'm already going to air layer it. This is already a two-year operation. I wait another year. Now it's a three-year operation. As a bone-size professional, you start to look at the water, the nutrition, the overwintering, the techniques, the timing, etc. And you say, it is a better decision to roll the dice and go ahead and push the tree and see if you can make it happen through good sound horticulture, good application of technique to expedite the process. I'm on board with you giving it a shot, all right? But you do have to be the ultimate judge of is the tree in a position to have success, because if it's not, then you're just going to kill the tree. And why did you repot? Now you've repotted it and killed the tree. It's like, well, that's like wiping before you poop. Why don't you just not repot? You know what I'm saying? So you be the judge, Alex. All right, James, can you share a particularly challenging project or tree that taught you valuable lessons about patience and perseverance or influenced your approach? Oh my God, that's literally every single tree at Mirai. But there's one in particular that comes to mind when I think about patience and perseverance. It probably formed a large degree of my anxiety that I used to not even have it in college. Sometimes I would feel anxious, but I didn't really know like what the name of that feeling was. And so I didn't talk about anxiety. And I would say in general, like, I don't struggle with tremendous anxiety. I try to attack the problems that I'm dealing with. Procrastination for me causes anxiety. And so when I start to see myself procrastinating and feeling anxiety, I try to attack the problem. But with bonsai, you know, like, Mother Nature is anxiety inducing, because it's like, okay, we're going to have temperatures in the mid 70s this weekend. And then I have no doubt that it's going to freeze and dump snow on us again. And all of the junipers and trees are starting to grow. And now I'm into that dreaded situation of not only the bonsai shuffle, but I've got 800 trees. So I'm bonsai shuffling on a physical level that most people can't fathom in terms of just logistical time to move things, space to protect them, etc. You know, that's anxiety inducing. But I had a tree, fantastic Rocky Mountain juniper, one of my favorite trees, and part of a really special trip that Randy Knight had in 2008. I acquired several junipers from that trip. They recovered, you know, I came back from Japan in 2010, this was one of the trees that I just really invested a lot of effort into. And it was fantastic. It was a tree that was very gangly. I had to, you know, hollow and wire spine and raffia a lot of the branches, which is not uncommon for a raw styling of a Yamadori juniper. But, you know, my interpretation and what everybody had told me about the Pacific Northwest is it doesn't snow that much here. Well, I Mirai, literally the boundary of my driveway, happens to be at the snow line for low elevation snow. It'll be raining at my driveway and we'll have 3 feet of snow up at literally 300 yards up the driveway in the garden at Mirai. It's happened more than once and it's fucking upsetting. It's a nightmare. Anyways, I go to bed one night. All the trees are on the ground because it's cold and we've had freezing temperatures and whatnot. And the weather person called for rain. I woke up in the morning and I'm not kidding you. There was literally 3 feet of snow on the ground and there was not a single thing I could do. And it was wet, heavy snow. And this juniper that had been, you know, hollowed and wire spine and raffia and bent, I could just see a little dome above the 3 feet of, and I'm not talking like an exaggerated 3 feet of snow. I'm saying there was like 36 inches of snow on the ground. And then that following night, we got 2 more feet. And when I stepped into the garden, the snow was literally up to my armpits and I couldn't see a single bonsai tree. Well, fast forward, you know, 4 weeks when the snow finally melts and that snow crushed the entire structure of that tree. I mean, and this is in 2010. That tree, it took 13 years to rebuild that tree. First of all, I can't believe it survived. All the interior, like all the long branches died because they broke, and the interior shoots literally grew into a new tree. So for 14 years, this fantastic piece of Yamadori that I had seen come to, you know, its initial like moment of glory, and then boom, it's all stripped from me like 2 or 3 months later, unexpectedly, like literally not called out unexpectedly, like there was not much I could have done. You know, now I'm a little bit more savvy and hip to the game of what life at Mirai looks like. But yeah, you know, patience and perseverance, it's like continuing to care for a tree that you loved and see decline, and then you're continuing to love it. It's like it's hard to stay in love with that kind of hardship. But one of the major lessons that I've learned is, well, there's multiple here. If you sit and watch a tree, it's never going to do anything. The moment you stop watching it, it's going to do things faster than you ever could have imagined. I tell you guys this all the time. But giving a tree and putting the weight on the tree and just letting a tree do its thing. Now, I've had to repot that tree 2 times in that 14 years. I've had to manage issues. I've had to balance strength. I've had to try and direct growth. I've had to sustain the deadwood and clean the live vein for board. You know, like that tree has had its had my hands on it, and yet it really didn't look that good until it was wired in the fall of last year. It was rewired for the first time in 13 years. It was rewired, and it's going to be a better tree. It's going to be a better tree than it was. You know, now who knows what would have happened over the period of evolution, but yeah, that was, I would say that's patience and perseverance. There have been trees at Mirai that just because of the overwhelming nature and so many things going on and trying to build the facility and stuff, you know, especially early on in my career, that I sort of took it for granted, the availability of material and whatnot. It's not that I didn't care for them, but I knew something needed to happen and I was slightly negligent with it. And one of the things that experience has also taught me is you've got to, if you think something needs to happen, you need to do it. You've got to listen to the fairy godmother of bonsai that sits on your shoulder. And this is a tree that has continued to prove that out. I had, you know, I'm watching it grow and I'm saying, gosh, it's growing very vigorously. That bark is really thick. You clean the live vein, suddenly there's a borer, you get rid of it. Tree continues to thrive. I need to manage the deadwood. It's looking like it's getting a little dark. You know, you go and wash it. Sure enough, there's a pithy region starting. You clean out the pithy area. Everything's rock solid. Deadwood's beautiful. You know, it's like all of these things that tree taught me, like a billion different lessons. It also taught me how to manage snow, how to handle trees that have been styled in the fall, how to think about junipers and the reduction process and their tolerance to environmental conditions after that. It's gajillion things. But that tree, that was really heartbreaking. And also I'm looking at it actually right now through the window as I'm doing this podcast because it's sitting up on a bench, proud, strong and proud. And I'm saying worth every moment of suffering to get to this point. David G, hey Ryan and team, there is so much on this app, amazing exclamation point. I want to add my trees but cannot transfer pictures from my Android gallery, wonder what I'm doing wrong. JP provided a response to this, because I think we talked about this in the last podcast, and I've had a number of people talk with me about this. But JP put a note in here for me to update you, David, because I got to be honest, I use the app, but I am not the app guru. JP is App Guru Deluxe. And he said, we're exploring options for added functionality for the photo picker on Android. We don't have an ETA on it. Yes, it is a limitation. It's a total pain in the ass. You want to talk about pain, talk about dealing with Apple. But this is one of the, you know, Android's been just a blessing and a gem compared to iOS. But this is one of the sticking points. So we don't have an ETA. There are a few workarounds that you can try. You can add your tree images into a Dropbox folder or Google Drive or a similar platform, and then you can select images from those locations instead of from your Android sort of photo file, right? So that's one thing, and a lot of people have had success with that. Some people are like, I don't want to start a Dropbox or a Google Drive just to use Mirai Mobile. And it's like, okay, all right, well, we'll continue working on solutions, but that's what we got for now. Or you can move the images to one of the available system folders, such as your downloads folder, screenshots, or pictures. Yeah, downloads folder or screenshots, like your temporary folder on your Android, and you can pull from those locations, right? So those are some workarounds. And you're saying, also, I'm finding it cumbersome to get to the Mirai Live library. What are the direct steps? The daily tips are like tidbits of flashpoints every day. Thanks, Carol. JP said settings, Mirai Live, and account will give you the ability to go directly to Mirai Live. Now, what we're working on, I'll just let you know, is in the descriptions of the calendar activities, putting the link to the video that would be the full lesson. So those will be things that are coming in the future. But currently, you go to settings and to your Mirai Live account in settings. And that'll take you directly to Mirai Live from Mirai Mobile. But we do have, again, that direct contact point coming. That's it. Fan questions. But I got a few more things for you guys just because I like to rock out. So repotting this year, we made some changes to Mirai at the end of last year. And one of the things, you know, changes to our educational system, obviously the launching of the app, we decreased the number of on-site classes to quarterly from monthly, and then we have a lot of private study, and it's been a whole new world. I miss teaching classes for sure. I miss the students and the interaction and the dynamics in classes beyond a shadow of a doubt. But, you know, again, the whole reason I did this is to do bonsai every day, and I really found myself like watching everybody else do bonsai. Like I was watching all the people that helped me in the garden do bonsai, and I was watching the students do bonsai, and I was just like frantically trying to keep up with all of the administrative stuff. And so, you know, we made some changes, and now I'm the only person caring for the garden, which means I do all the drenching, I do all the wiring, I do all the pruning, I do all the repotting. And it has been such a pleasure, and also so busy / stressful. But you know, the biggest thing that I notice, and this is true of anybody, look, Michael Jordan in the off season still needed to practice his dribbling and shooting. Like, you know, Kobe Bryant, like people who excel at their endeavors don't ever stop doing that endeavor. Like you never get to a point where you're so good at something that you don't need to keep doing it. You know, Mr. Kimura, one of the things I realized about Mr. Kimura that I was just like so freaking impressed with, one of the many, he was the hardest working bonsai professional in Japan. Mr. Kimura is not the best because he sits and eats bonbons and let his apprentices do all the work. Mr. Kimura was a grinder. He did bonsai daily, all day, daily. And there are a lot of bonsai professionals in Japan that, you know, do bonsai pretty well, pass most of the work to their apprentices, get more into the lifestyle of managing clientele, business, etc., which this is the pitfall. It's a necessary thing. I don't know how Mr. Kimura ran his operation from a business perspective because he didn't share that with us. I know other, you know, apprentices or other masters in Japan share different aspects of their, you know, personal life, family life, business aspects of bonsai with their apprentices. Mr. Kimura with his apprentices was strictly about the trees doing bonsai and, you know, the interactions that surrounded those activities. So I don't really know how he managed all of that, but doing Bonesai, being responsible for things, continues to reinforce what I already knew, which is there is no substitute. You with your tree, you know, people talk about watering systems, people talk about hiring help, etc. Listen, look, hey, here's the deal. You with your tree, that's the most important thing that you can do. And there is just something innate about being the person who is handling, caring for, watering, moving. Also, let's just be honest, here at midnight when I forgot to close the greenhouse, and here in the snowstorm, not able to go home, sleeping on the couch, or, you know, blowing snow off of the trees, like covering the gauntlet of it. I love it. I love it. I love it. You know, in the apical nutritional thing, doing the drenching, that was my biggest concern, was am I going to be able to keep up with the drenching and do the bonsai work and do the repotting and do the pruning and do the teaching and do the and do the and do the and do the and do the. And the answer is yes, because it just took some reorganization and figuring things out for me personally, like mentally as well as, you know, practically. But also yes, and what a lot of people don't understand about bonsai, because it seems like this vanity thing and it seems like there's all these prepackaged solutions to tree health in the form of, you know, pelletized fertilizer and chemicals and, you know, bags of soil and moss and et cetera. It's like all of this stuff comes pre-cooked, and you say, okay, so I should just be able to water out of the hose, and I should just be able to put this pelletized, you know, pile of crap on my tree, and I should just be able to spray this bottle on it and get rid of the things that I don't want, and everything should be good, right? And it's like, yeah, kind of. But what I've learned with the apical thing over the past 3 years, and I'm really starting to see it kick in now, which I've been a huge proponent of it. I've been a very vocal proponent of it. I'm going to encourage you guys to do it, is it's making me a farmer more than I've ever been a farmer. And it's giving me such a greater appreciation for the intimate relationship and knowledge that I've always aspired to have horticulturally with my trees, that I was trying to find solutions for while still using this prepackaged, like, you know, sort of, what do you call it, one size fits all solution. And it just, that's not the reality. That's how the world's gotten itself into the position that it's in, which is a lack of sustainability. That's not the reality. And to do bonsai on a high level, we all have to accept that we are farmers to a degree. We are farming tiny trees in small, shallow pots. And that is a complex endeavor. And if you're willing to get your hands dirty and really dig deep and really observe and really learn, there is a tool in the form of sap testing through apical and customized nutrient applications that if you stick with it and you invest in it, I'm telling you, will make your trees do things that you never, ever fathomed. Never fathomed. I never fathomed that I could see a Rocky Mountain juniper do the things that they're doing, or a ponderosa pine do the things that they're doing. It's really been a pleasure. It's really been a pleasure. And it's a pleasure to be back at the helm of it. It's so exciting that, you know, my house is almost not going to be done for, you know, several years. It's a lifetime project, what I'm building at Mirai. It's totally a pursuit of passion. And, you know, it's a big vision that's built it to this point and a bigger vision that's going to carry it on. But I'm almost to the point where I'll be able to live here again. And God, dog, super exciting. You know, the app is out there. You guys are rocking on it. We're able to engage with you in new ways as a result of freeing up our time. We're still streaming in a different format that feels so good. Yeah. Awesome stuff. Good vibes. As we enter the spring, really good vibes. Wishing you guys all the best. Love the support. I love the community. We wouldn't be here without you, and we are continuing to work hard for you. But we're in a position where I think, you know, more than monetary mutuality, I'm feeling more of a mutuality in terms of the community support and appreciation for the effort that we really put in for the app and everything that we've delivered. Go find another bonsai professional doing it. It's just not the case. I know there are other people trying. I know there are other people doing things that are maybe look the same. Maybe we're even directly ripped off of what Mariah's doing, you know, plagiarized stylistically, aesthetically, functionally. Maybe they even call it the same thing. It doesn't matter. It's not Mariah. So, repotting questions, fan questions, bonsai geekery at its finest. Love you guys. Keep it real.